Kia ora koutou, hello all. I'm Ani White and this is the Where's My Jetpack podcast. To give some context for our international listeners, Waitangi Day is Aotearoa New Zealand's annual commemoration of the signing of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the treaty between Indigenous Māori and the Crown, which was soon violated. So this Waitangi Day, we're broadcasting a talk on Indigenous history and constitutional transformation by Aaron Matariki Kā. Aaron is of Ngāi Tūhoe and Ngāti Awa descent and currently lives in Tāne Atua, north of Te Rawera Rainforest. Aaron is a lawyer. She is co-manager of the New Zealand Alternative, a non-profit organisation creating informed public debate relating to Aotearoa's place in this changing world. And she is co-leader of River, a non-profit seeking to revitalise Indigenous values for Earth's regeneration. This talk was originally delivered at a conference of Fight Back Australasia on January 23rd this year. Just a note before we proceed, due to technical issues, we're unfortunately missing the first part of the talk. So Aaron began by saying, pre-colonisation Māori society was governed by principles of kawa and tikanga, and she goes on here to define kawa and tikanga.
So kawa is nature's law, nature's principles. One way of understanding it is as the upper jaw. It doesn't move, it remains still, it's always the same. So an example of kawa is that the land was here first, we are children of the land. As tangata whenua, we are of the land. So we have a responsibility to the land, as a child does to care for their parent. You know, if we come from the land, we rely on her for life, and without her, we have no purpose or existence together. That is a simple kawa that is undeniable, natural law. Another example is about women. So women are the creators of life. We are the whare tangata. We are the portal between realms, between te pō, or the night. See how it's all grounded in worldview. So between te pō and te ao marama is the wahine. We are the portal. And so the wahine, the role in our society is as a creator, as a nurturer, as strategist, and we are tapu because of that. And so that reflects in our legal system how wahine are treated. So with colonization coming, the patriarchy and then the oppression of women is a very real, very relevant thing that's tied into the constitutional transformation. Tikanga is like the lower jaw. So part of the same thing, but it moves as dependent on the needs of our time. So tikanga is known as the law for humans, like human-made law for humans. So tika also means correct. And tikanga is like correctness. So it's like the right way of doing things, you know? So tikanga may adapt over time. It has been described as the purpose of tikanga is to maintain appropriate relationships of people to our environment, to our history, and to each other. So while tikanga can adapt over time, there are underlying principles that we need to be aware of, no matter who we are here in Aotearoa, that just never change. And those are whanaunatanga, which is whanaunatanga is like whānau, like together, being connected and related to each other. Manaakitanga, this value of hospitality or of caring for one another. Aroha, which is like love, just a value of love. Mana is harder to describe. I think the best translation I've heard of mana is responsibility. So as your mana grows, your responsibility grows. So being responsible for things. Tapu and noa. I won't try and like translate all of these things, but if they're familiar to you, these are all conceptual regulators, is how they've been described by Eddie Jury, who's another Māori judge. And tapu and noa are sort of about this balance between what is sacred or and what is no longer sacred. So it kind of determines, say, for an example, of whether you can enter a space or not, or whether, how you relate to a space is often governed by these concepts of tapu and noa. I won't go into more than that. And utu is a really important one. It means reciprocity. So sometimes you might hear it explained as like an eye for an eye, but it's not always a negative thing. So utu is really connected to manaakitanga. So if I was to invite you to my place, I would invite you, I would care for you, give you kai and food. And in doing that, that would actually uplift my mana, because I am hosting you and holding you in my space and caring for you. But in response and reciprocity, that manuhiri or that person then responds in some way. And that can either be immediate, so between me and the person, or it could be intergenerational. So yeah, getting a bit deep on some of these, but they're all really important things that we need to learn about and understand and uplift as part of this transformative process. Okay, cool. And the other thing to note about kawa and tikanga is that tikanga varied between hapu, right? So we're talking about pluralistic things. So even though those underlying values were very common, and you'll find them throughout our islands in Aotearoa, they also varied depending on the hapu. And one hapu, hapu is like a sub-tribe. So there's like a tribe, basically, like an extended family. So one hapu would never dream of going to another person's land or another hapu's land and imposing upon them out their tikanga, right? If you were to be hosted by a group, you would go there with the knowledge that they were there to care for you in accordance with their ways of doing things. And then you would respect that. And then when those people came to you, you would do the same, and they would have the same expectation. So that's a really important thought for when you think about when the British arrived and those initial kind of relationships between Māori and Pākehā. Māori welcomed in accordance with manaakitanga. We hosted, we fed, we cared for. And then later on in our colonization, this other legal system came and was imposed upon us, which actually brings me to this next point. So when the Pākehā came, so I really like that phrase. It's like, here we go, since time immemorial, living on these lands in accordance with our own worldview and our own ways of doing things, our own way of relating through wairua, through spirituality, to our surroundings, our gods, our language, everything that allowed us to be ourselves and to identify as ourselves and live and experience this wonderful world, was then imposed upon. And then the Pākehā came, you know? And so when the British Crown landed, there, of course, was this honeymoon period. But the reality is that they came here with a worldview of superiority, that they are superior and had this right of entitlement to take and to dispossess. And that is grounded in law. So I'm not sure how familiar people are with the concept of the doctrine of discovery, but this is a very important origin of this Western legal system that we have today that unites us as Indigenous peoples and as stolen peoples around the world. This doctrine of discovery, which is over 600 years old, is basically like the foundation of it is basically a series of documents called papal bulls. I don't even know what that, I just think of a bull, like, you know, a charging bull. And they're issued by the Catholic Church. And they're essentially the moral justification for white European nations to go out and dominate non-white, non-Christian lands and peoples. So I've got a little explanation here, do it a little bit better than me. The 1493 papal decree, so there's like maybe nine, I'm sorry, I don't know for sure, but there's a series of these decrees or papal bulls that were issued over time to just justify certain aspects of colonization. And one that's super relevant is one that was issued in 1493. And just on that, we're in 2021 and we're talking about this freaking thing from 1493, which still has influence on our legal system today. So this decree aimed to justify Christian European explorers' claims on land and waterways they allegedly discovered and to promote Christian domination and superiority. It has been applied in Africa, Asia, Aussie, New Zealand, and the Americas. So the decree was that if an explorer proclaims to have discovered the land in the name of a Christian European monarch, if they plant a flag in its soil and they report his discovery to the European rulers and then they return to occupy it, the land is now his, even if someone else was there first. Now, should the original occupants insist on claiming that the land is theirs, the discoverer can label the occupant's way of being on the land inadequate according to European standards. And this ideology supported the dehumanization of those living on the land, their dispossession, their murder, and their forced assimilation. So the doctrine fueled white supremacy insofar as white European settlers claimed that they were instruments of divine design and possessed cultural superiority. That is, in my view, the origin of the Western legal system, is that superiority complex right there, and the imposition of that on our countries. So skipping ahead now, Aotearoa is fortunate in that we were colonized very late in the peace. So I'm really careful about that word fortunate, but in some ways, you know, it's all messed up, obviously, but the reason why we're fortunate is because it's only been 180 years, which is obviously ages, but in that time, we actually have probably the closest proximity to the mātauranga, or the knowledge of our tipuna, our ancestors, than any of our whānau around the world who were colonised 400, 500 years earlier. Right, so that gives us, in terms of our responsibility, I see for Aotearoa New Zealand, particularly in this movement for constitutional transformation, to recognise our privilege, in the sense of being in a position now to actually transform, and just to recognise and acknowledge that if we can do this, that a rising tide floats all boats. So our transformation will have influence on other countries and other Indigenous solidarity, you know, Indigenous movements, particularly in common law countries, because our common law systems, that's how they work. The common law influences each other. We're often looking to Canada to see what they're up to over there, and Australia, and we use their decisions in our judgments on our lands. So that reality is that reality. So that's something to sort of explain. So the other thing that happened in Aotearoa was, because we were so late in the peace, there was this sort of movement in Britain at the time that pushed for the British Crown to actually come up with a treaty with Indigenous peoples. And that's where Te Tiriti o Waitangi, from a British perspective, came from, right? It was like, oh, shit, if we're going to take over these lands, well, we better try and do it in a nice way. and so obviously in 1835 we had Te Whakaputanga, which is a declaration of independence. And that's really relevant to our constitutional transformation, because it's in its name, claiming rangatiratanga, which is key in Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And it was 1835, it's recognisable, it's there, it exists. And I've heard Professor Margaret Mutu actually describe Te Whakaputanga as a written constitution of Aotearoa, which I think is a really interesting take. And I haven't dived more into that, but just he whakaaro, there's a thought for you guys. Now, just in case we're not up to date with the treaty, I'll just jump into that really briefly. So 1840, February, it's a big gathering in Waitangi, and between many northern chiefs and rangatira and the British Crown. And they're only there for a few days, and they spend a lot of time debating what a treaty would look like. And the context, the historical context of this treaty making, is super crazy important for us to carry forward and to share, because at the time there were about 2,000 white settlers in these lands in Aotearoa, and the estimation is about 800,000 Māori people. Okay, so like that context, like there's no way that those Māori people who each have their own hapū with each of their own tikanga and an understanding of not imposing tikanga on each other, there's no way that we would voluntarily be like, actually, guys, you guys take over. Like Britain, you guys take over. We'll cede all our sovereignty to you. You seem to have it all together. Like that's, which is the Treaty of Waitangi is what that says. Whereas Te Tiriti o Waitangi, just sort of, I can't see people's faces, but there are two documents for the treaty. There's Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which is the Māori language version, which is the version that was debated and agreed upon and mostly signed. It has over 500 signatures. Then there's the Treaty of Waitangi, which is the translation into English, which says the complete opposite to Te Tiriti, and was not debated and was only signed by approximately 39 rangatira. And I've read that there's a historian, Alan Ward, has argued that those rangatira were assured that it was the translation. And I know that the Treaty of Waitangi was only signed where Te Tiriti wasn't carried to. So once they'd signed the treaties up in Waitangi, it travelled right round the North Island, was signed by various chiefs, and never made it to the South Island. The South Island was claimed, sovereignty over the South Island was claimed by the British by cession, just simply discovery. So there's Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which is the one that we talk about, that we care about, that actually remains true. And Te Tiriti o Waitangi at international law is also the version that you would uphold. Our politicians don't see it that way, though. Our politicians are still a bit confused about which one applies. And our legal system, colonial legal system, also does not apply Te Tiriti as like a law. Instead, we've had cases in the courts where the judges have given us treaty principles, where we're trying to uphold the spirit of the treaty, which is stuff like good faith between the treaty partners and fiduciary duties and all that sort of stuff. That's problematic because it's watering down Te Tiriti. And I realise I haven't even explained what's in Te Tiriti. Sorry, I get really excited about these. So Te Tiriti very essentially safeguards tino rangatiratanga for hapū Māori. Tino rangatiratanga is translated to the notion of sovereignty in English. And it also grants the ability of kāwanatanga to the British Crown. Kāwanatanga is a transliteration of the word governance. So we kind of talked about why the British entered into the treaty, but from a Māori perspective, we entered into the treaty because we had a whole lot of loose settlers rocking around up north, just claiming stuff and rocking around and stuff, and there was no order with these people. And I think that the hapū up north were kind of getting worried about this reckless random behaviour that they were seeing that had no tikanga governing it. And instead of imposing our tikanga on it, we invited the crown to come over and look after their own people. So there was a granting of governance of kāwanatanga in Te Tiriti, and the intention behind that was actually to allow the crown to care for their own people. Really, it wasn't an invitation to now take over and, you know, be our sovereigns. So that's probably, I mean, if you guys have any questions about the treaty, that's probably all I really wanted to say about the treaty there. About those two documents meaning the opposite thing, and we look to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and that's what we look to. So in terms of constitutional transformation and Mātiki Mai, we're looking at Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and we're seeing a way forward within that for our constitution and for how we relate to each other and for how we transform into a society that actually honours Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Another way of looking at it as well is that we safeguarded tino rangatiratanga, right? So sovereignty for Māori, and then we granted kāwanatanga. And so another way of looking at it is to see that kāwanatanga is actually subject to tino rangatiratanga. Whereas in practice today, it's the other way around, right? Like there's the crown has this parliamentary supremacy of sovereignty, and they're allowing Māori to do certain things so long as it fits within the colonial legal system. So that's our current reality. If you think about the actual true meaning of Te Tiriti, it really was Tinoranga Tiratanga reserved, as it had been for millennia, that legal system, and Kawanatanga was going to be subject to that. So I think that's a useful kind of way of looking at it too. Awesome. So just take a breath and have a look at some notes. So yeah, just in reflecting on that history, I think that's really, really essential stories to be sharing right now for all of us, because it gives us, it grounds us in like the historical context of where we're standing right now. And it brings me to like this idea of decolonization. And decolonization is a really, really important work. And obviously, and you guys, I've seen Fight Back. I just like love it. It's like struggle, solidarity, and where is my word? Struggle, solidarity, and socialism. And I think that's really just, to me, talks about decolonization. One thing also about decolonization is it does center the colonizer. Even in the language of it, decolonization, and it centers this concept of change, like of kind of reacting to the colonization. And it also centers this idea of struggle, right? Like ka whawhai tonu mātou, we will fight forever and ever, rangi nui waka. And that's very real. And we acknowledge all of the resistance and our ancestors around the world who have been doing this work since colonization. Another way of kind of looking at the work of decolonization is also looking at this concept of restoration or reconnection, which I think is more positive in the sense that it doesn't center colonization, it just centers back on Indigenous ways of doing things, the Indigenous worldview, and therefore the Indigenous legal system. So restoring kawa and restoring tikanga and those values underlying it as a means of transforming how we are in our society, how we relate to each other, and how we relate to the land. And I really like to think about that because, though, like, and I think we need both, so I'm not, you know. And so I think what I like about it is it sort of gives me a better sense for the future for my children and grandchildren. And in the sense that struggle is no longer central to our identity, which is obviously very much part of our story, but do we, it's a question, genuine question, do we want it to be central to our identity moving forward? Whereas restoration of kawa and tikanga and those values that we live by is sort of like, yeah, it's like a nurturing. So instead of ka whawhai tonu mātou, it's like a ka tipu tonu mātou, like we continue to grow. And it's like putting all our energy into like loving ourselves. And that's radical. And like loving our ways of being and loving our ways of doing things and making decisions and sharing and being with each other. And so we definitely need both, especially right now in this political environment. But I just think that's a really nice point to highlight. Yeah, sorry. Okay, cool. So restoration. And maybe I'll share. So one of the strongest examples of this alive right now that probably isn't talked about much is in Tūhoe. So Tūhoe is one of my iwi. And I went in, when I went home to Tāne Atua in 2017, I went to work for Tūhoe Te Rūtau Matua, which is our post-settlement governance entity. And I did 2 years with them, but I finished about a year ago. I'm still in the same place doing cool stuff. But basically, in the Tūhoe settlement, we had two acts. One was passed, like the apology to Tūhoe people and acknowledgements for the wrongs that happened to us. Yep. Cool. And then this other act called Te Uruwera Act. Te Uruwera is Indigenous rainforest known as Te Manawa o Te Ika Māui. It's a huge forest that is based at the heart of Te Ika Māui, so the heart of the North Island, basically, more towards the east coast. And she is still an Indigenous rainforest. Te Uruwera is our mother, the mother of the Tūhoe people. So, and we have been there since the mist married the mountains. So Tūhoe people don't say that we came here only on a waka. We are descendants of those that came here on canoes from Hawaiki, but we're also descendants of the mist and the mountains of Te Uruwera. And that's how we got our name of being children of the mist. So that's us, Tūhoe and Te Uruwera. Te Uruwera is our mother, and in 2014, as part of our settlement, she was granted legal personality, which means that she owns herself. So she's no longer a national park owned by the Department of Conservation. She is not owned by the Tūhoe people. She owns herself in law. And so if, say, someone decided to go in there and cut down a tōtara tree, the forest would be the one that would sue that person. Okay, so that's how she owns herself in law. She has a board appointed to speak on her behalf. And like a company, you know how in companies, the like the director's duties are to like have the best interests of the company foremost. Well, the first duty of these of the nine members of this board is to have Te Uruwera's interests first and foremost. So this board in 2017 issued a management plan, which is called Te Kawa or Te Uruwera. So it's like a legal system, Te Kawa. Kawa, tikanga, of Te Uruwera. And it basically is like the Tūhoe perspective or worldview of how we're going to relate and care for Te Uruwera. And it flips resource management on its head. So instead of managing a resource, we are actually managing humans for the benefit of the land. So it's human management for the benefit of the land. And that recognizes the fact that the land was here first. The land and the living systems of Te Uruwera, of this forest, is so complex and so ancient and enduring that as humans, as mere humans, we are not able to fully comprehend all of that. So how could we therefore give ourselves permission to manage that if we can't comprehend it, right? And then it also recognizes the fact that all the pressures that are on Te Uruwera, including from all the way from climate change right down to the introduction of rats and deer and pigs, are all human made, you know? So it's actually the humans that need management, not the land. The land's been here forever. She will be here forever, way after we're gone. It's the humans that need management. We are, in a sense, extremely arrogant to ever assume like an ability to manage the land and to own the land and to be therefore superior to and in control of. And that's, you can see now, hopefully this case study, this example is showing you the dance between these two worldviews, the clashing actually of these two worldviews. And so Te Kawa o Te Uruwera allows us, it's like a starting point in itself, and you can find it online. It's a really beautiful management plan. It is, as a management plan, it is written mostly like in prose. You know, it's not set like, in 2021, we will kill 80% of rats. So it's nothing to do with stats and all that sort of stuff. It's a much broader, it's an introduction to the Tūhoe perspective, the Tūhoe worldview. So I think really relevant. For me, that's probably the strongest example of transformation in our law, in our legal system to date, is Te Kawa. But I just want to say, because it's super amazing, right? Like, this is amazing, and it exists, and it's in force, and it's actually enforceable in our colonial legal system because it's through legislation, right? So we have all of this infrastructure to care for the land in a way that's consistent with a Tūhoe perspective and to, like, roll out these new ways of being. But the limitation that we have there is the fact that we are still colonized. And I think this is super relevant for this discussion. We're still colonized. We're still suffering the impacts of colonization. And so whilst we have this incredible legal infrastructure here, our people are still like this, you know? Like, why would you care about rats in the bush if you can't feed your kids tomorrow, you know? So we don't. And so there's this disconnection again between what's legally available and what's in reality possible. And so this is how the relationship between people and the land and people between ourselves and each other where it really starts to intertwine is we need to care for ourselves and get ourselves to a point before we can really meaningfully start to care for Te Uruwera. And yes, it's possible to do these things at the same time, but those relationships need to be acknowledged in this struggle or in this movement, I suppose. Cool. And just keep an eye on the time as well. So really happy to answer any questions on that stuff there. I think it's fascinating and really important. The last sort of thing that I really wanted to talk about is, because I know that our audience today is mostly Tauiwi or Pākehā, and so I just want to remind everybody that, like, all this history is very real. All of this this context is so important for us to really know, and we need everybody, you know? And I know that, like, there's a lot of, especially on social media, there's a lot of cancel culture and call out culture and all that stuff. And I understand that. And I understand its place. And especially for calling out things like white privilege and white fragility and all of those things are really, really important. And that's all good. That's happening. But, like, as Anime Kaede kind of points out, there's no point Pākehā people wallowing in guilt, you know? So, like, even if you get to the stage of understanding all of that history and stuff, you go through this guilt stage, and that's still natural too, and I really don't pass judgment on anything being good or bad in this process of decolonizing ourselves. It really is something that we have to physically experience, as well as, like, that sensation of guilt and shame is all a very natural part of our process. But to move through that and to get to a point where we can actually help each other to decolonize and to restore these legal systems and values, I think that's where I want to be. And so how do we do that? You know, like, how do we create those spaces of dialogue? Because there's a lot of catching up to do. There's a lot of learning. And you'll know that Māori do not have the time to be, like, educating everyone to catch you up to where we are or, you know, whatever. So there's a lot of kind of learning and acknowledgements that we have to do on both sides. But so long as we can agree that we want to be at the space now that we want to be building together towards basically a restoring of Indigenous worldviews and legal systems and ways of being. And there was this really cool quote that I read, and it was about that Pākehā identity. And it says, "I am Pākehā because I live in a Māori country." I thought that was a really useful way of understanding that identity, because this is what it's about. It's where do we see ourselves? Like, how do we see ourselves? At the moment where we are at is Pākehā law and identity and ways of doing things are dominant and they're our normal. And it's actually very difficult to imagine another way of doing things because it's been dominating us for so long. And that's, you know, just as Joe acknowledges this too, our biggest challenge right now is our imagination, being able to imagine a world where we can operate by our own values is the next step. So I am Pākehā because I live in a Māori country. What that means to me is trusting Māori to create space for Pākehā to be. So instead of imposing Pākehā culture and worldviews and legal systems onto Māori as we're currently doing, it's actually like this restoration process actually requires Pākehā to step back, acknowledge all this history, and create space for Māori to lead and to indicate where, like, in our legal system as well, Pākehā fit. And if you can trust in the fact that we believe in values like manaakitanga, whanaunatanga, utu, reciprocity, you know, those things, then we actually have mechanisms to find space for everybody. And Pākehā and Tauiwi alike, because we have to acknowledge we have huge populations of all sorts of different cultures here in Aotearoa. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. And it needs to be a big part of our discussions as well of constitutional transformation, as where do these new cultures that are coming here and settling in Aotearoa, how we all fit together. So for Tauiwi and Pākehā, where and how to kind of, like, what to next? So in my view, one of the biggest things that we can be doing is living aligned with the land. So really understanding the impact that we have in our daily lives on Papa Tuanuku, from like, you know, our waste, our food, where we get our food from, our choices of fashion, of buying things, of, you know, our mode of transport, all of those different impacts that we have. I think recognizing those and trying to shift those to be more aligned with Papa Tuanuku is a really practical and effective and very real way of actually uplifting tikanga and kawa, because that is one of the first principles. The first kawa is Papa Tuanuku as our mother, and we have to care for her and respect and love her. So doing that practically is living in alignment with the whenua as much as you possibly can. I know people living in cities and everything, but if we start there, that's, you know, that's a really big thing. And then more specifically, there's some really cool advice from Tina Nata, who would also recommend reading, reading alongside Anemi Kaire and Moana Jackson and Justice Jo Williams. And I'll just read out a couple of these that I really liked. So one of her first advice is be toe, or at peace with your position. So what did she say? You need to be able to speak frankly about the process of colonization that has created space for you to be here in Aotearoa, not ridden with guilt and not trying to explain it or evade it, but ready to respond to the legacy of that story. Be aware of your own privilege that has descended down to you by virtue of that process, even in describing your own class, gender, ability, sexuality based on oppression. You should know how the legacy of colonization influences your experiences of that oppression. So I like that concept of be toe with your position, not overridden with guilt, but at peace and acknowledging those things. Second one is to respect boundaries. So in recognizing, acknowledging that Māori and others are colonized peoples, that we need space to decolonize ourselves and to relearn ourselves and to learn to love ourselves. You know, all of those things mean that it can be unhelpful when tawiwi or Pākehā step into a space and say you're trying to learn the reo and then you're trying to teaching it. So your best intentions, I've just had experience of this, so I'm trying to explain it from my view now, but your best intentions to learn, but then there's this need to show it or demonstrate it. And I think that can actually be really unwise and unhelpful, because it's not acknowledging the fact that we are actually still trying to build ourselves up. Speaking up is another thing that Tina Nata highlights, is standing with Indigenous peoples for our language rights, our health rights, for the rights of our children and women, and to stop perceiving Indigenous issues as just something that's kind of siloed over there. It is inevitable of colonization that we have to fight for these things, and the more Pākehā allies that we have on board with it, the stronger politically the movement, and then obviously legally we will be as well. And the final one that Tina's, she's got 10, but I'm just highlighting the ones that really speak to me, is don't expect back pats and thank yous. You're probably going to get them anyway, because that's where we're at with this work. But when you're in that space, I suppose it's kind of like recognizing that you're stepping into a whole new world, a whole new world view. And so if you can kind of, it's like humbling yourself into a position of learning and listening, and of like contributing in that way. And I think maybe the more you do it, the more you'll see those spaces. And I really, really, you start to acknowledge, you can start to see people who have kind of been in the space for a long time, because they know when to keep ideas, or they know when to share, you know. And I think that's a very, very helpful thing to be doing as tawiwi and Pākehā, is sort of creating space, acknowledging space, and being very wary of those things. And also finally, reading. Do some readings. There's some really cool stuff out there. We're in an evolution, like constitutional transformation is evolution of our legal system. And we're in it's the middle of it, started in the 80s. So there's like so much, so many articles out there, and there's going to be some movements this year, hopefully, with the New Zealand Alternative, who I'm working with, and a bunch of other groups, to start to translate some of those legal academic whakaaro ideas into more accessible kind of resources or artworks that we can all start our dialogue on. So that's coming, hopefully. And yeah, so read up on it and start to like really think about this decolonization and restoration of these things, and what you can do in your life to, in your work, in your communities to kind of uplift these values and ways of being.
Thanks for listening. You can find links to organizations Erin is involved with at the blog post for this episode at jetpack.zoob.net or jetpack.zoob.net, as well as a link to the Matiki Mai report on constitutional transformation in Aotearoa. If you like this episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever platform you use. We've got more episodes coming up on a range of politics and pop culture topics, including more talks from the Fight Back Conference, which this episode was recorded at. Kia kaha, be strong, good night, and good luck.